Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Fewer and fewer people in Washington still cling to the belief that things are going well in Iraq. High hopes have been pinned on the elections, now just 20 days away. But the violence has gotten worse, and the insurgency seems to get more brutally effective every week. The introduction of more powerful roadside bombs, the assassination of high-level officials, allies announcing the withdrawal of troops, and the erosion of public support for the occupation. The list goes on. And now the Pentagon is sending a highly regarded general to try and figure out how to stop the bleeding, literally as well as figuratively. Bad news is nothing new in this war, but there seems to be a weather change in Washington. The administration calls it pessimism, but others, including some prominent Republicans, call it realism, and it is changing the conversation. Tonight on Point, exiting Iraq, when and how the U.S. ends its occupation. We begin in Washington, where my first guest is reporting that exit strategy has now become a hot topic there. David Sanger is Washington correspondent at the New York Times. David, welcome.
Thanks very much.
You wrote today in the Times that the rumblings about disengagement have grown distinctly louder. Where are those rumblings coming from?
Well, they're coming from everywhere. You certainly hear it on Capitol Hill as people return from the Christmas break, and, you know, they've heard from their constituents and others about their continued concern about the casualties. You hear it a lot at the Pentagon, where they're worried about the strain on the Army. They're worried about the strain on the extended tours of duty for the National Guard. They're worried about the $4.5 billion a month that this is costing, and knowing that that is going to, you know, be coming out of something. So you've gotten a fair bit of that there. You're hearing a bit of it from people around the White House, but not necessarily many within it. As, of course, that's the hardest thing to pierce. We have no evidence that the conversation about when to begin disengagement has begun with the president, other than with the past stated metric, which is when the Iraqi troops can begin to take over for Americans.
Well, I was going to ask, is this largely wishful thinking about disengagement from Iraq if President Bush is not part of the conversation?
Well, it may be now, but it may also be the beginnings, and I say here may be the beginnings of changing what the measure is. Remember, in the past, the measure the president has always used is that as soon as the Iraqis are ready to be trained and take responsibility for their own security, at that moment, the U.S. will begin slowly, obviously, not a run for the exits, to disengage. Now there's sort of an interesting alternative scenario coming up, which is raising the question of whether or not the sheer size of the American force at this point poses such a huge target to the insurgents that having a large force there is counterproductive, and that a much smaller force would pose less of a target. Now, this argument's been around for some time, but what's interesting is you're hearing it more and more within the military.
Well, with these January 30th elections coming up, if in fact they are the turning point, how soon after those are over will we know whether the result is more stability or more insurgency?
Well, it may take a while to know that, but I think the big thing to watch for is the reaction of the Sunni minority, because if the Sunnis feel as if they have remained a part of this process and can work within it, then I think that there will be, you know, a good chance that the insurgency will not gain strength. If, on the other hand, this turns into what Brent Scowcroft called the other day the possibility of an incipient civil war, then I think that you'd probably recognize that relatively quickly. But remember, it took a long time to understand the nature of the insurgency that we're now facing, and many believe we still don't fully understand how many are really committed insurgents and how many are just increasingly unhappy Sunnis or Baathists or what Donald Rumsfeld once used to refer to as dead-enders.
But certainly day by day, I mean, we see the headlines about the 13-member electoral commission in Anbar resigning. Now Baghdad's deputy police chief has been assassinated. I mean, day by day, it just is sounding worse and worse.
Well, one of the things I think is most disturbing is that the people who are clearly targets, deputy police chief, the mayor of Baghdad the other day, people who you would assume would have pretty good security around them, are themselves falling victim to this insurgency. And that tells you that it's digging in even deeper.
And how significant is it that, in fact, it is Republicans now who are part of this conversation about things not going well?
Well, I think that's very important. And when my colleague Eric Schmidt and I were reporting this out, we talked to almost exclusively either the military or on the Hill to Republicans, because Democrats have been doing this for a long time. And, you know, quite frankly, their views are not likely particularly to sway the president or his senior advisors. But when you're beginning to hear from a growing swath of the Republican Party, that's a different situation.
David Sanger, thanks so much.
Thank you.
David Sanger is Washington correspondent for The New York Times. He spoke with me from Washington. And we're talking this hour about the United States getting out of Iraq, when and how that might happen. Have we reached some kind of tipping point in Iraq? With public opinion shifting on the war, is elite opinion starting to shift too? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now in the studio is Owen Cote, Associate Director of the Security Studies Program at MIT. Owen, welcome.
Thank you.
And with me from Washington is James Dobbins, Director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND. He's held senior White House and State Department positions under four presidents. Most recently was the Bush administration's special envoy for Afghanistan. He's co-author of America's Role in Nation Building, From Germany to Iraq, and has an article just out entitled Iraq, Winning the Unwinnable War. It strikes a sobering tone in the January-February issue of the journal Foreign Affairs. James Dobbins, welcome to you.
Thank you.
We heard what David Sanger had to say about the talk changing. What are you hearing, and how do you account for the change?
Well, I think people are beginning to face reality, to recognize that all of the yardsticks, things are getting worse and we're losing. And I think they're also beginning to recognize that while this upcoming election may help in some regards, it's not going to be the silver bullet or the magic key, and that the insurgency, at least in the Sunni parts of the country, is, if anything, likely to intensify afterward.
You also say in this article that the choice appears to be between making things worse slowly or quickly. What are those choices exactly, and how so?
Well, what I'm saying is that the United States has lost the confidence of the Iraqi people. The Iraqi people look to the United States to protect them, to offer them security. We proved unable to do that. They, in turn, proved unwilling to commit themselves to us and to act to marginalize the insurgents. What I'm suggesting is that having lost their confidence, we are not ourselves capable of leading a successful counterinsurgency campaign in Iraq.
Politically as well as militarily?
Well, I think that our forces are the galvanizing a force that is radicalizing the population and increasing support for the insurgency, both in Iraq and in neighboring countries. This insurgency, unlike the insurgencies we faced during the Cold War, doesn't have a unified ideology. It doesn't have a unified leadership. It's unified only in opposition to the United States and in a desire to expel the United States. But to the extent that the United States presence becomes less prominent, I think there's a reasonable prospect that the opposition will begin to fragment and that the Iraqi regime will have an opportunity to divide it, to bring some elements of it into the political process, to marginalize and ultimately eliminate the rest.
Owen Cote, I want to bring you into the conversation. Do you see this as an unwinnable war?
Well, I agree with most of what is it Ambassador Dobbins?
That'll be fine.
Good. Okay. Or Jim said. The thing that is really the dilemma, though, is that in the last couple of weeks, one of the on the military side, one of the things that I think you can see the administration realizing is coming true is that their plans for training an Iraqi force that could stand on its own 2 feet are also not going forward very well. And we can talk more about the details of that in a minute. But it does put you in a little bit of a bind because, as I think Jim means when he talks about you can make it worse quickly or make it worse more slowly. I mean, if you just leave, I think everybody agrees that that without an Iraqi force that can kind of maintain some semblance of control, you really have a disaster on about 4 or 5 different fronts. But it's just proving really difficult to fashion an Iraqi force with the small leadership skills and the ability to stand in the face of what they encounter, certainly in the middle of the country. And if you so that puts a timeline on even a very what based on our prior, you know, going in assumptions were even a kind of minimalist strategy, I still think is going to take a lot more effort and a lot more time if we don't get that really if we want to avoid that really bad outcome.
Well, you think, for example, about basic training for American troops. That's what, about 6 or 8 weeks? Clearly not sufficient for these Iraqi troops.
Oh, but I think that if you look at the training of U.S. troops and, you know, any Western army, basic training is just the beginning. And so, you know, even in a case where there is no you're not in the middle of a war, under the most ideal circumstances, you're talking a year and a half, 2 years. And, you know, under these circumstances, it's a much more challenging situation. So I think there was some belief when we started this process of training the Iraqi forces with General Petraeus, the hero of Mosul and so on during the initial occupation, I think there was a belief that I think even at that time, even under the most ideal circumstances, they could get something ready by the election. And I think even then that was kind of over-optimistic. It's surely been shown to be such, you know, in the last 9 months.
And James Dobbins, how about you? Do you see this as a problem with training or morale of the Iraqi army or both?
Well, I think there are problems with in both respects, and I agree that this is not something that's going to occur overnight, and an American withdrawal that is too rapid, as I've suggested, could make the situation worse quickly rather than slowly. On the other hand, if you accept the logic of what I've suggested, which is that by staying, we're also making things worse, albeit more slowly, and that there are therefore risks associated with staying, those to some degree offset the risks of leaving and provide a basis for accepting a bit more risk on that side. So I think that rather than waiting until the Iraqis are clearly ready and the insurgency has been successfully defeated to begin an American withdrawal, we need to take the chance that by beginning to draw down, and in particular not so much by beginning to reduce the number of our forces, but beginning to reduce their prominence in the counterinsurgency, getting them out of the cities, stop using American artillery and American aircraft to bomb and shell urban areas where civilian casualties are almost an inevitable byproduct, and reduce the level of our involvement in these kinds of operations. I think if we accept that we're making things worse slowly by staying, that we should accept some risk in accelerating that pullback from our current level of engagement.
In the few seconds we have before we have to take a break, Jim Dobbins, good move to send this retired 4-star General Gary Luck into there to take a look around?
It certainly can't do any harm. I would guess that he will come back with at least some conclusions that are compatible with what both of us have been saying so far.
All right. We're going to continue our conversation in just a moment. We're talking this hour about U.S. disengagement in Iraq, when and how the occupation of Iraq might end. What's your roadmap for exiting Iraq? When do you think it should happen and how? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about disengagement in Iraq, the latest buzzword in Washington. When and how do you think the U.S. will leave there? Do you think we've reached some kind of tipping point? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And with us is Owen Cote, Associate Director of the Security Studies Program at MIT. Also Jim Dobbins, former U.S. Special Envoy to Kosovo, Bosnia, Haiti, Somalia, most recently Afghanistan, and now the Director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND Corporation. Jim, I want to pick up with one of the other points in your article where you talked about the, and we've been talking so far about the some of the downsides of keeping troops there for a long time, but on the other hand, what is the risk of withdrawing those troops too quickly?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the risk of withdrawing them too quickly is that the regime collapses. And the country is plunged into an uncontrolled civil war, which ultimately draws in neighboring states and becomes a conflict of the sort we saw in Yugoslavia, for instance.
Do you
or Afghanistan for most of the last 20 years.
Do you think then there should be a date certain after which we get out? I mean, what are the upsides and downsides of that?
I'd be skeptical about a date certain because it simply means that your opponents are given a time period during which they can wait you out. And it's a little too mechanistic. I think it's a question of direction. I think it's a decision to begin a process to leave enough flexibility at the pace at which one goes, but begin progressively to diminish our prominence, diminish our role, perhaps also diminish the size of the U.S. force there, to put more responsibility on the Iraqi shoulders, even if one is not certain that they are ready to bear it, and even if one recognizes that they will encounter some setbacks. But I also believe that we need to do some other things, as I sketched out in my article, independent of the military situation if we're going to stabilize Iraq.
For example, you talked about dramatically recasting the American role in the region. Give us some specifics there.
Well, I think there's several things. First, we need to engage the neighboring states in a constructive way in stabilizing Iraq. We discovered in Bosnia that we couldn't stabilize Bosnia without the active cooperation of the two powers and the two men who were personally responsible for the genocide we were trying to stop, that is Milosevic in Serbia and Tudjman in Croatia. We had to engage with them. We had to make them our privileged partners in a process of stabilizing Bosnia if we were going to have any chance of doing so, and we did so successfully. Similarly, in Afghanistan, we quickly concluded after 9/11 that we weren't going to be able to stabilize Afghanistan unless we engaged the countries that had been, in fact, tearing it apart for 20 years, Russia, India, Pakistan, and Iran. And we engaged them and persuaded them that what they'd been calling the great game didn't have to be a zero-sum game, that they could all gain by supporting the emergence of a moderate, unified Afghan state. And we succeeded in doing so. We went into Iraq without a plan to engage the neighbors constructively and to secure their support for the emergence of a unified, moderate, representative Iraqi regime. And I don't think we can stabilize Iraq unless we get that support. So that's one important component. A second component is recasting the American the themes and the basis for American engagement in that region. What we've talked about for the last 3 years since 9/11 in that region are counterterrorism and democratization. And these themes have a lot of inherent validity and even a potential support in the region. The regimes all fear terrorism. The populations all want more democracy. But we've given these themes their trial runs in occupied Palestine and occupied Iraq. And as a result, they've become discredited in the eyes of many of the people of the region. And I think we're going to have to return to some more traditional themes like sovereignty, territorial integrity, peace and stability and begin emphasizing that these are our objectives in Iraq if we're going to engage the neighboring states and get their help in cutting off the flow of supplies, of men, of money, and most of all, cut off the flow of moral support to the insurgency in Iraq, because that's what's most important. And lastly, probably the key thing we can do to begin to change regional perceptions of the United States is reengage as an intermediary in the negotiations between Israel and its Arab neighbors, in particular the Palestinians, to not become the uncritical supporter of one side, but to become a genuine intermediary in this peace process.
All right. Well, Owen Cote, what do you make of that thesis, and how would you strike that balance between too soon, too late, too early, not early enough?
Well, the thing that I worry about is that I don't have any issues with the idea of reducing our profile in the heart of the cities, in the middle of the country. The Fallujah is the best example, but there's all sorts of the other places. Sort of scaling back to a kind of much lower profile, not making an attempt to go into these places and blow up buildings, looking for people, and so on and so forth. That's a strategy that might make sense at this point, given that the opposite approach doesn't seem to have made the insurgency doesn't seem to have reduced it, and in fact may be increasing. But what I worry about is that, unfortunately, if you want a political group to stand more on their own, if you want them to be more responsible for the territory and society that they are living in, you have a situation in Iraq where you have a very divided, the potential for civil war obviously is always there. It's very great. And unfortunately, what you find a lot of times is that the most effective forces domestically are actually kind of welded and forged in those kinds of situations. And one of the things that I'm concerned about is that if we pull back and give more responsibility, I'm not talking about in the heart of, Ramadi or Fallujah, but it's just in general, there's one armed group in the country that we've heard nothing from, which is the Peshmerga militias in the Kurdish areas, which are quite formidable as those militias go in the area. We have heard from the Shiites, but so far it seems like the dominant groups in the Shiite society in the south have kind of bought off Muqtada al-Sadr for now. But we saw that dynamic for a while there. And so what I'm worried about is that if you give people too much military and police responsibility, they go and they use it, and they use it for their, the purposes that they perceive to be in their interests. And you can just it's a very difficult balance to strike. So pull out of these kinds of military campaigns in the hearts of the Sunni Triangle cities. Sure, I think we should probably do that and see if that helps. See what happens after the election. See if the people that are anointed can cut some sort of deal with tribal leaders in the Sunni areas. But in terms of the overall ability of the United States military to control, the country for the time being, I think we're already kind of weak in that respect. And I think we should wait a little while before we see how clear things are before we start withdrawing down to, say, a number of 50,000, which is the number you hear, and so on and so forth. That would reduce our profile, but it would dramatically also reduce our ability to, influence events as well.
Let's get some of our listeners in on the conversation from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. We have Ross on the line. Hi, Ross. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Well, the concern I had just listening early on in your program where you talked about what has changed. And I guess in my mind, nothing has changed. I mean, a lot of the dialogue is the same that we had before the election, insurgency and the like, and the current administration kept on talking about how we were going to be able to train the Iraqi forces and that was going to be to play, that freedom was on the march, we're going to have elections in January, and that there are going to be stable elections, and we're going to have democracy in Iraq. And what's turning out to be is all not true, that we can't train these folks in time for us to be able to get relief for our own troops, and that the reality is, and what's coming out in all of the op-eds that you read, is we're not going to wind up with a democracy in that country. We're going to wind up with a theocracy. And those folks who actually are not pro-American, and, you know, and then you have all of these other stories that are coming up about, you know, radical Islam, you know, fundamentalists, and you know, looking at whether our generosity around the whole tsunami and Asian situation is going to be, you know, seen as terrific. And the reality is that these are folks that don't want us in their country. It's going to wind up be a theocracy, and we can't seem to pull our troops out in time. So my worry is that now we've got 4 more years of this administration who's promised us all of these things, and I'd love to hear from this panel, you know, what do we do as Americans? You know, what are other influences that are going to hit the administration where we're going to be able to make some policy changes here, because clearly the ones that we have are not working.
Ross, thanks so much for the call. And Jim Dobbins, let me put that question to you. We heard David Sanger talking earlier, and I'm sure you read his piece in the Times today about how President Bush doesn't apparently want to be part of this conversation. So are there other ways that people who are concerned about this can bring some pressure to bear on the administration?
Well, I think that the administration is going to maintain that it's not going to change policy until the day it changes policy. So, I mean, the fact that they're saying steady on, no change, doesn't mean anything except that they're not ready to announce a change. It may mean they don't intend to change, or it may simply mean they haven't decided yet on what change they have in mind. I think that there will almost certainly be some re-equilibration after the Iraqi elections. And I agree with what Owen was saying earlier, that we're going to have to maintain enough presence in the country to play a significant role in ensuring that the political maneuvering after the election doesn't lead to a further breakdown of cohesion within the country. I think one of the roles of the American forces there is actually restraining our friends. It's restraining, for instance, the Kurds from any military move into the northern oil fields, which are not currently within their territory, but to which they aspire. I think we're going to have to use our influence with the Sunni, with the Shia, who are going to win this election, to reach out to the Sunnis and to give them a stronger place in the government than the election results will justify. So there's going to be an important balancing role for the United States, but I think it can be a role which is less prominent in terms of our interaction with the Iraqi people, and in particular with our responsibility for military actions, which impact negatively on their lives. I think there are going to be some bloody and difficult battles in the future, but ideally there'll be ones that don't involve the United States quite so centrally.
Well, and Owen Cote, if we're looking at possibly building as many as 14 U.S. bases in Iraq, we talked earlier about trying to lower the profile of American troops there. I mean, isn't that a pretty clear signal that the United States plans to be there a very long time, if not permanently?
Well, it could certainly be interpreted that way. But you got to – I mean, there is a – I'm only being slightly humorous here. But, I mean, wherever the military goes, it just brings the U.S. with it. And that's just – you know, that is kind of how we operate, which in and of itself is a potential problem. I don't think these bases are a sign that we intend to stay there forever. I do think the administration is sincere when they talk about the desire to eventually, you know, leave Iraq to the Iraqis. I think there were some in the administration maybe had dreams of, you know, having U.S. forces based in Iraq afterwards, like, you know, in West Germany during the Cold War. I mean, fortunately, those dreams are long gone. But so the bases themselves don't signify an intent to stay, but they may be part of the problem. But it is just a fact of life that the military, U.S. military, when it goes places like this, it brings the swimming pools and it brings the, you know, and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I'm being a little sarcastic, and that's far from what the conditions are in many parts of Iraq for the U.S. forces. But relative, you know, to how a lot of other militaries operate, we tend to do that. But if you don't mind, I wanted to related to the question our caller has, and also some comments Jim was making, I do think that you can see signs of a potential shift in administration policy, thinking along some of the problems that we were talking about. And this is my interpretation of General Luck's mission to Iraq, which is General Luck, retired Army general, has been sent by Rumsfeld to review specifically the issue of training Iraqi forces. A week or so before the announcement was made that General Luck was going over there, you had one of these things where leaking out of the Army was indications that the Army is now looking at embedding U.S. forces, small numbers of U.S. forces, in Iraqi units directly. So this is the classic role in some sense that special forces troops have played in the past, where their job is to actually serve as a little bit of a backbone at the very small unit level, be involved in their training, but then also go out with them into the field. On the one hand, I wouldn't volunteer for that duty right now if I were, you know, if I were in the Army or the Marines. But the fact that they're looking at that and the fact that the Army's looking at that does tell me that I get a sense that people are looking at this option of changing the role of the U.S. military in the ways that Jim's been talking about to reduce its direct profile and, most importantly, its responsibility for the outcomes of some of these operations. Now, even if they're planning on doing that, I still think that it's going to be a challenge and it's going to be a while before such a policy could bear fruit. But I do think that that's in some sense the purpose of sending him over there, which is to have him come back and bless that approach and see where that takes us down the road.
To our phone lines again, to Raleigh, North Carolina. Pradeep is on the line. And Pradeep, we just have a very short time before a break. So quick question, please.
Yeah, very well. A quick comment is that, you know, listening to your panel, it was a scary thought. I mean, it just looks like at this point of time, damned if we stay, damned if we get out. Quick question. Iraq was created by the British. Here's my thinking is that given that it looks like a bad option in any way, is there any chance that, the country can be, well, cutting up is a bad word, but can be segmented into different enclaves, the Kurdish enclave somewhere, one part in the north, and the Shiite enclave, that where people can have, some stabilizing control, and with that slowly have some over semblance of control over the bad areas, really.
Got it, Pradeep. Thank you so much for the call. And Jim Dobbins, can I ask you for just a headline on that point, and then maybe we can expand on it after we come back?
Well, I think the answer is no, not without large-scale ethnic cleansing and bloodshed of the sort we saw in Yugoslavia.
All right. Thanks so much for being so brief. We're continuing our discussion in just a moment about U.S. exit strategy for Iraq. Disengagement is the new buzzword in Washington. Do you feel a shift in public opinion? When and how do you think the United States should get out of Iraq? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about exiting Iraq. With elections now just 20 days away, should the United States be preparing to declare some kind of success and cut its losses? Or would that set the stage for further mayhem in Iraq? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're speaking this hour with Jim Dobbins, former U.S. Special Envoy to Kosovo and many other places, most recently Afghanistan, now Director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND Corporation, and also with Owen Cote, Associate Director of the Security Studies Program at MIT. Owen, I want to give you a chance to expand on Jim's headline of a moment ago about whether, to Pradeep's question, whether it makes sense to let the country sort of naturally subdivide itself into three kind of ethnic areas.
Well, I mean, I agree with Jim's headline, and the sort of the story that would follow the headline would be that it wouldn't be a natural process, and that the groups are all, you know, to some extent intermingled amongst each other. So if you have a minority now and you partition, that minority becomes a majority, and you have a minority now that within that area that would be in the same situation. But I think there's two big things about partition which are problematic. And the first, obviously, is that the Kurds would love it. Of course, all of the neighboring countries with Kurdish minorities would hate it. And so this would be a recipe, even if it were somehow peaceful, for bringing in the outside, the neighbors in a not helpful way. And we want to avoid that. But I think the other main thing is that the one in some sense, positive thing about how the war has gone, or the post-war has gone, has been the relative quiescence and support, using that term advisedly, amongst the Shiites for, you know, the political process that we kind of got pushed into that's leading to this election. And, of course, you try to solve the Sunni problem by partition, you're going to create a Shiite problem, which would arguably be even bigger.
All right, back to our phone lines now. Mike's on the line from Boston, Massachusetts. Hello, Mike, and welcome.
Thank you.
You have a question for us?
Yeah, a quick question, or more of an observation, really, for you gentlemen to discuss. But I'm a combat veteran of Iraq myself, and I think that in the discussions of the speed of pullout, the point is being missed that you're basically asking guys to stay on the ground for what is essentially a face-saving solution. If, in fact, you believe, as I do, that it is a lost war, then it's unreasonable, really, to ask the guys on the ground to stick around and get killed while we try and extract ourselves slowly and gracefully. It's almost like Vietnamization all over again.
Mike, thanks so much for the call. Jim Dobbins, your response?
Well, it is a bit like Vietnamization, and we did keep troops in Vietnam for, I think, 5 years after that program was originally set in train, and it became very controversial in this country. On the other hand, it actually worked. That is, the process of Vietnamization and the changes in U.S. strategy after the Tet Offensive, which put pacification over search and destroy, broke the back of the Viet Cong insurgency. When we left, the Viet Cong insurgency had been defeated. Now, what hadn't been defeated was North Vietnamese conventional main force units, and they invaded South Vietnam after the U.S. Congress cut off further military assistance, and we lost the war. But we didn't lose the war to an insurgency. We beat the insurgency. There's no external conventional threat to Iraq. So if a process of like Vietnamization could succeed as well in Iraq as it actually did in Vietnam, there's some chance that it would work.
Jim, I also want to pursue a point that you made in your article about the civilian losses on the ground in Iraq. I was struck by your comparison with U.S. losses on September 11th.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that given that Iraq is something like 10 times smaller than the United States, indeed, I think like 15 times smaller than the United States in terms of population, they receive a devastating blow on the dimensions of 9/11 every month, indeed every week, sometimes every day, an equivalent number of people, given the smaller population base they have, is lost. Now, you know how traumatic that was for the United States. Imagine if you were losing that proportion of your population every day or every week, how that would traumatize your population.
In fact, it's even worse than that, in a sense, because the losses are overwhelmingly focused on one part of the country. So, you know, Jim's point, you can multiply it another two or three times, because the Sunnis, which are bearing most of the brunt, are 20% of the population, we think. So it's absolutely right. There's a huge toll here on the Iraqi side of these operations, which is why that point about who's responsible for them is so important. We are overwhelmingly both perceived and are, in fact, responsible for those now. And the desire to Iraqization, if you want to call it, the Vietnamization model, is to get out of that business.
And a final point that you make, Jim, again, in your article, is about how if you want to defeat an insurgency, you have to do that with civilian support. You really can't do it with troops alone.
Right. You don't win an insurgency. You don't win against an insurgency by killing insurgents, because they will breed faster than you can kill them. You win against an insurgency by bringing the population over to your side and isolating, marginalizing, and eventually eliminating the insurgents.
Well, in just a few seconds we have to try to wrap this up, Owen, are you optimistic as to how this is going to turn out?
I am still curious about what's going to happen after the election, and specifically I'm still curious about what the relationship's going to be between the Shiite parties in the South and Alawi's group. And if there's reasonable balance between those two, I'm interested in the deals that they can cut with themselves and potentially with some of the leadership and the tribal leadership in the Sunni areas. I think it's the last sort of optimistic, semi-optimistic thought that I'm going to have about this war if it doesn't work well.
Owen Cote, thanks so much for being with us. Associate Director of the Security Study Program at the MIT. Also Jim Dobbins, who joined us from Washington. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
In just a moment, the axe falls at CBS over last fall's story about President Bush's military record. This is On Point. The independent panel investigating a 60 Minutes 2 story on George Bush's National Guard service released its findings today, and it was not good news for CBS. It accuses those involved with the story of showing a disregard of basic principles of journalism and of a myopic zeal in their desire to be first on the air. The panel recommended that three top news executives and a veteran producer be fired, but not the correspondent, Dan Rather. Bob Thompson is director of the Center for the Study of Popular Television at Syracuse University. I asked him to hit the rewind button and remind us how this whole controversy got started.
Well, back in September, 60 Minutes Wednesday edition, what was once called 60 Minutes 2, does this big story, first episode of the new season, about the President George W. Bush's service in the Texas National Guard. And, you know, for the most part, most of what they reported was nothing new. I think most thinking people who have been following all of this, and in a lot of its public record, know, in fact, that a lot of the stuff that people have claimed about his service and not getting a physical and all of the rest of it is true. And they kind of had gone on with it. This was a story that had been told. Well, this was just another little bit of evidence that was reported here about this service. But it turns out it was a set of documents that were bogus, that had come from a bad source. There were all kinds of red flags that they shouldn't have reported it. CBS reported it anyway. All these bloggers took one look at these documents and the typeset and all the rest of it. They did the due diligence CBS should have done on it, and CBS all of a sudden found themselves in the middle of one big fat mess because their entire set of journalistic standards seemed to have broken down from the basement to the attic in the case of this particular story.
So what specifically, what should they have done, what would they have done normally in checking out a story like this that they didn't do this time?
Well, they accepted documents that were simply mimeographs. There were people who were telling them that, you know, if you publish these when, in fact, we know that this typeset is problematical and the rest of it. I mean, they were getting all kinds of indications that this information was bad, that these documents weren't authentic, that their source was not a reliable one. Any one of those things would have been enough not to run a story until you'd gotten some further confirmation. I think in the end they wanted to get this thing out there. It was going to be a story that wouldn't matter too much longer. Remember, this is September. The elections are going to be in November. It was timely, and I think they simply wanted to get it out there. I don't believe, and neither does the independent report that just came out, that this was somehow politically motivated to torpedo the president. I think, in fact, it was some really shoddy journalism because there was so much zeal to get this particular story out there. The report makes some really strange statements in it, too. The idea that Dan Rather, who, by the way, does not get fired or, for that matter, even much of a slap on the hand, he gets to return to the scene of the crime. He's going to continue to work at 60 Minutes, as far as I can tell from this, which is where all this happened. It justifies what he did, that he had been kind of overextended, covering the conventions and the hurricane and that kind of thing, that he wasn't able to vet this with the scrutiny that he normally would have. I mean, I suppose I can understand as a fellow citizen how that would happen. I'm not sure that's a very good excuse for a guy in the position he was in doing a story this important, this close to an election that could have some bearing on the election, that ultimately made claims that one of the people running in that election committed what could be a felony. So it's a pretty serious mistake that they made.
And do you see it as something of a preemptive strike by CBS, perhaps to announce Dan Rather's retirement in March, knowing that this information was going to come out? Because the funny thing is, he will stay with 60 Minutes Wednesday, which is where this report aired. He's stepping down from CBS News, and it didn't air there.
Well, this is what I just don't get. And there's a lot of decisions that come out of CBS that I don't get. And sometimes I'm not sure there's not much there to be gotten. If, in fact, they had Dan Rather step down or make his announcement, which conveniently came a little bit before this report came out, it didn't give the sense of any punitive action, because CBS and Dan Rather kept claiming that he was going to do this anyway, and it had nothing to do with what had happened in this particular report. So then the report comes out that says what we expected. Yes, in fact, this story shouldn't have run. There was a breakdown on any number of levels. At that point is when you want to send the message that, no, we at CBS don't let our people get away with this. And that's when the heads roll. And three executives were asked to resign. One was, in fact, dismissed, but not Dan Rather. And as you point out, the really odd thing is, yes, Dan Rather has stepped down from the nightly news, which I suppose is supposed to be perceived as that he's been punished enough, but he's going back to, as I said before, the scene of the crime. 60 Minutes is where he will be reporting, and that's the place where all of this happened. That strikes me as very odd. I think probably at least the producer, the correspondent, and some would argue the president of CBS News should have all taken the fall for this having been broadcast. But I think especially the most visible character, Dan Rather.
Well, Rather aside, what about the other people who did resign or were terminated? Did they get the right people or no?
Well, I think a lot of people are still saying, why didn't it go all the way up to the top at the head of the news, where the buck ultimately stops? Certainly the producer, I think everybody realized that she was going to have to be fired over this. I mean, that was the person who actually was in charge of this particular story, and I think there was no question that she was going to go. I think they also got an executive producer and a vice president. And yes, I think when these things happen, this P.T. Barnum approach to journalism really shouldn't be tolerated. I think when this or the Jason Blair case or anything like that happens, I think you have to cut fast and I think you have to cut deep if you're going to retain your credibility. And let's face it, credibility is what these places manufacture. If you take away the credibility to the point that nobody believes what you're saying, your reason to exist as a news operation completely disappears.
Do you think this report is going to put the controversy to bed, or will it linger?
This will put the controversy about George Bush's National Guard service, as it's been reported by the media, to bed, because it's already an old story. George Bush re-won the election. Everybody knows about this National Guard thing and doesn't seem to care much about it. This is the end of this particular story. Is it the last scandal of journalistic ethics that we will see? I think absolutely not. You and I will probably have this conversation within the next couple of years when yet another one comes along.
Bob Thompson from Syracuse University, thank you, as always.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Bob Thompson is director of the Center for the Study of Popular Television at Syracuse. I'm Gail Harris. This is On Point.